people cringe because once they take the Newtonian level and they use this, they actually have almost all the equations being conserved. The eighth wave approach relies on going to some of those equations that have absolutely no source and putting a source here. So you put things that have like go like dV. And they prefer not to do that. So traditionally, they deal with this problem, the problem of the weakly hyperbolicity, in a different way, which is the following. Once you come in here and you look at the characteristics of the system at the eigenvalues, and you find out why is it that you only had, we only had seven eigenvalues, seven eigenvectors, when we were supposed to have eight, it turns out that you get a degeneracy that is proportional to divergence B. So there is a degeneracy. One of these eigenvectors is degenerate. Eigenvalue, sorry, is degenerate due to dV. If dV is exactly zero, the degeneracy gets broken, and all of a sudden you recover the eighth eigenvector. So you have two options. Either you fix it in this way, for instance, this one particular way of fixing it, that allows to, for all arbitrary type of perturbations, even perturbations that violate the constraints, the constraint, the monopole constraint, to have a well-defined system of equations. Or you insist at the numerical level by working really, really hard that this guy will be satisfied, that the monopole constraint will be satisfied to Randall's level. And there is a well-defined technique that is called, in the literature, constraint transport. That does precisely this. It enforces the divergence of B to be exactly, or at round of error, not at truncation. So truncation is order A to the P, right? Whatever order of your scheme. Round of mean 10 to the minus 14 if you're using, say, double precision. So even though the equations, all the equations have an error ordered H to the P, because that's a truncation error that you have, when you evaluate that, all the these truncation error terms cancel in exact form that to leave at the end of the day this 10 to the minus 14. So it's okay. Depending on who watches this, I might not be able to say this, but it's involved something that's completely ugly from my point of view, but it works, so I cannot complain too much. But there, what they say is, so the basic of the technique is some variables are placed where we would say these are your grid points. Some variables are placed there. But some are variables are placed staggered in space and time. So some variables live here in a very complicated way. And in three dimensions, it's even more complicated because you have to stagger in all possible directions. But the funny or the interesting thing is that even though, as I said before, you have errors in every single variable going at sh to the p, when you take the divergence of b, you get all those errors canceling exactly and leaving just a round of error. So that's a way around, kind of at the very practical level, at the level of the discretization itself, to deal with this problem. I personally and my colleagues personally work with this approach or some other one that is kind of analogous, which will be related to something that Franz Pretorius will discuss next week, which is you can add extra variables to your system. You can penalize your system by adding extra variables if the constraints are not satisfied. But you do it in such a way that you drive these dissatisfactions to zero, and you're going to see the example next week in explicit terms. And in the end, that made a huge difference in the way we, in our ability to iterate Einstein's equations. But let me just not get ahead of myself. Okay, so now let me discuss briefly the second problem, the puzzling problem that I mentioned here, that all eigenvalues are less than c, where did our speed of propagation at the speed of light go? And to do that, I'll just simplify the problem and think of it from the Newtonian point of view, or sorry, at the non-curved space-time point of view. So I'm going to imagine that we're doing as you did in electromagnetism. So electromagnetism is a relativistic theory. We're going to assume that we're in a Newtonian spacetime or in Euclidean spacetime and just writing the equations on top of that. So a few observations are the following. So remember, we wrote Ohm's law, the covariant form for the relativistic form of Ohm's law is given by JA, JB, UB equals sigma, FAB, UB. And sigma is the conductivity of whatever medium we're dealing with. So let's express these, re-express this in terms of the E's and B's that we have defined. What you'll find in that case is that now J in the spatial direction is given by sigma, the Lorentz factor, E plus B cross B, minus E dot B. So that's Ohm's law. Some pieces are familiar from what you've seen in the past. J being proportional or equal to the charge times the velocity it has. So a charge moving at a given velocity generates a current. So that's the contribution there. And we again have different pieces, extra pieces that contribute. So the first observation is that we took the limit of sigma going to infinity. If we take the sigma going to infinity, we better have a current that is non-divergent, because otherwise we would be dealing with a nonsensical physical problem, because this is the J that we then put in the source of our equations. So if we're going to be able to take this limit and things will still make sense when we do so, it better be that this combination is equal to zero. That's the only way that we otherwise will get with that. So once we do that, we can do two things. So this has to be equal to zero. We can take we can get two equations out of this, one by projecting along the velocity, and one by projecting along the orthogonal to the velocity. So parallel to v, this equation implies, so if I dot this with v, I'm going to have a contribution from here, no contributions from here, and a contribution from there. So it's going to tell me that something like E dot V times 1 minus V has to be equal to, 1 minus V squared has to be equal to 0. And if this has to be satisfied for all cases, then it tells us that E and V are orthogonal to each other. And if I take the component orthogonal to V, so I take the cross product of this equation with the velocity, then we get that E is equal to minus V cross V. And these are things that we already knew from our earlier discussion, but here we can just understand it just purely from the current point of view. So let me remind us of Maxwell's equation. So Maxwell's equations. So we have, let's imagine that we have some charge distribution in our problem. We have the no monopole constraint. We have then the evolution equations for electric and magnetic fields being like this. Equal to zero. That's the current we have. So let me just do two things. So let me take the time derivative of this equation and then replace the time derivative of E with respect to this other equation. So if I do that, what I find is, what I have is, where we have used this equation, we replace Q by divergence of E, and then we end up now with this equation, which is not typically what you would have seen. In the vacuum case, you don't have this term because sigma is zero. Now, because we have a current, we have to account for this. And this is the problem we mentioned last time. We want to take the limit of sigma going to infinity, and we want to see what is the effective system that it gives rise to. We said that E will essentially be, in this case, we're taking the Newtonian limit, so little e and big B are the, big E are the same. So E should be something that is essentially zero. So dt of E is essentially zero. So then, if we have dt of E is equal to zero, I can take this equation, take another time derivative of this equation, and we're going to have dtt of E plus the curl of dt E, but we're assuming dt of E is equal to zero, then this should also hold true for a second time derivative of B. So one thing I'm going to do is I'm going to divide by sigma. And so we end up with two types of equations if we want. Either if we're going to divide by something that goes to infinity, so we're going to divide by a zero, and we want something sensible, it better be that this one is also equal to zero, which then implies a new equation for the magnetic field, which is this one. So in the limit, we throw away this part, and this is what we end up with. And now we see where we lost our C. Our C was hidden here, right? We have second time derivative of the magnetic field minus the Laplacian equal to zero. It has characteristics given by plus minus one. But now when we throw away this one, we end up with this one. And if we analyze the characteristics of this one, notice we have the curl of B cross B. When we split this out to obtain our principal part, or our matrix, we're going to have something that has a velocity V sitting in front of the derivatives of the magnetic field. So this is where C went. It was lost in that particular step that we took, but we end up with something that is physically sensible. And it is a good description for cases where the conductivity goes to really large values. So now the question is, well, we know how to deal with, or we think we know how to deal with, cases where the sigma is very, very high. What would we do in cases where the sigma is low, but it's non-zero? And so that we could talk about a different approximation. I'll just give you the name. It's called force-free approximation. But this is where I'm going to stop and ask you what you guys want to do. So tomorrow, either we're, as I said, I ask you to think about what you would prefer. Either we discuss things like this, this are approximation, how you can treat cases that are very low densities, or we can take tomorrow class as in our lab. And we just come in here, you guys work on your project, and we can talk about the projects themselves or any other thing that you might have, or you think that might have gone too fast, or you'd like to go deeper into it. So what is your choice?
You choose.
I need to know, because I have to prepare. We have one thing or the other. Don't be quiet.